The Jimtown bar itself isn't an impressive sight, but the beer can pile out back most certainly is. Documented by National Geographic and Guinness World Records as the largest beer can pile in the world, it dwarfed the actual bar where the twin mottos which appeared on the back of souvenir ball caps had always been, where the can of whoop-ass is always open, and Friday night special, shot, stabbed, or raped. I got tired, the way I always did when approaching such establishments, and hoped that Luann, the proprietor for the last few miraculously quiet years, was about. I started to follow along toward the door, but paused when I saw an old, faded, powder-blue Dodge with a white replacement door that read Coal Strip Concrete and a phone number belying its age with only four numerals. I stopped. The moment must have lasted longer than I thought, as Lolo paused with her hand on the front door of the bar and looked at me. Something wrong? I thought about repeating the conversation in reverse, but decided her mood wasn't conducive. I've seen that truck before. There are only a couple of thousand vehicles on the res, so I bet you have. She pushed the door open, but instead of going inside, turned to look at me. Where?
Bernie.
Red or white?
I'll tell you later.
I glanced at the truck one more time, then caught the heavy glass door and followed her into the interior gloom, lit only by the red neon spelling bar in the small windows. It was still well before opening time, but a familiar character sat on one of the massive log stools bolted to the concrete floor. Tom Paine had been the unofficial mayor of Jimtown for as long as I could remember. Half Cheyenne and half Crow, he was the perfect peacemaker for the just-off-the-res bar. He was a small man, so his best technique for breaking up beer brawls was to get the patrons to laugh with an unending stream of politically incorrect native humor, most borrowed from Herbert his Good Horse. He leaped off his stool as soon as he saw us. Ha-ho! Lolo held up a hand to stop the coming tirade as I wandered over to the jukebox at the far end of the bar. Tom, is Luann around? No, she went to Billings for a hair appointment. His voice became more excited as he thought of a joke to tell. I got this one off the morning show the other day. There were these two cowboys out riding, and they came onto this Indian lying on his belly with his ear against the earth. I thumbed through the machine's old-style tabs as Long's voice sounded dubious.
She left you in charge?
No, Natty Tominski is here, but she's in the bathroom.
He continued with the joke as if she hadn't interrupted.
The one cowboy turns to the other and says, "See that Indian? He can put his ear to the ground and hear things from miles away."
I got to the end of the song listings and then went back in the other direction just to make sure I hadn't missed it.
About that time, the Indian looks up at them and says, "Covered wagon, pulled by two oxen, one white, the other speckled, one man, one woman, three children, and a black dog, wagon full of all family supplies." The one cowboy looks at the other one and says, "That's amazing." The Indian continued, "Yes, ran over me about a half hour ago."
Lolo chuckled in spite of herself and glanced toward the two bathroom doors, one marked Squaws, the other Braves, that led toward the pool table past the jukebox where I stood.
"Tom, sometimes—"
And she finally laughed wholeheartedly. His eyes almost disappeared in the folds around the sockets.
"It makes me happy to see you laughing the way you used to, little O. You don't laugh enough anymore."
She gently placed a hand on his shoulder.
"I guess it's the job, Tom." She took a deep breath and glanced over to me. "I've had some help with that lately, though."
I leaned against the jukebox and tipped my hat back in an aw shucks manner. "No Ballad of Ira Hayes."
She let the hand slip from the mayor's shoulder and crossed to me. "No?"
"No."
I glanced at Tom. "When's the last time they changed the music on this machine?"
He shook his head, looked at the floor, and then back to us.
"Never that I know of."
"That means that Artie didn't call from here."
She studied me. "Then where?"
"Could have been anywhere. A cell phone in Artie's truck, a home stereo, or a radio station."
Tom watched us like we were a tennis match, but I cut him off before he could start in with the jokes again.
"The key is the woman. If we know who the woman is, then we know where the place might have been."
"And why are you telling me this?"
"Because I think you know who she is." It was at that point that the squaw's bathroom door opened, and two individuals of separate sexes exited. One was an obese woman with a modified beehive hairdo and way too much makeup. The other was a skinny white guy with a shaved head, a flame tattoo spiraling up his neck, and sunglasses despite the gloom inside. The man held a brown plastic grocery sack and looked very surprised to see us. I smiled. "Mr. Kelly Joe Burns, I see you have your belt on." He paused there for a second, pushed Natty Tominski toward us, and then dodged behind the bar through the doorway toward the back. It took both of us to catch the screaming woman, who stumbled, fell halfway to the floor, wrapped one arm around me and the other around Chief Long's leg, and held on for dear life. The chief was the first to disentangle, and she lithely leaped over the bar and through the back door. "Arrest her!" After getting the woman to her feet, I handcuffed her to the refrigerator and went outside to take a quick look at the blue Dodge. I busied myself for a moment and then went to the right in the direction of the as-big-as-a-very-large-house giant pile of beer cans, but couldn't see where Lolo and Burns might have gone. I stopped by a dumpster, which was made out of a couple of 55-gallon drums sitting on a crumbling concrete pad next to the huge pile, and listened. It sounded like the cans were being stepped on and were sliding down the hill. I approached the gigantic assembly and worked my way around the periphery. Lolo Long, with her sidearm drawn, was 30 feet above me and was panning the .44 around the area. She must have half seen me and swung the big Smith toward my chest. "Whoa, Chief!" She raised the barrel of the revolver skyward. "Where is he?" "You don't know?" She slipped on the mountain of crushed aluminum and almost fell.
"No, he disappeared."
I circled the base of the thing, held in check by the remnants of an old foundation, and figured that must have been how the largest pile of beer cans in the world had started. Somebody had run a wheelbarrow at the back and dumped them into the place where a building must have been in the 20s, and the tradition had continued on into the 21st century. The smell of stale beer, even in the moderate heat of the morning, was sinus-clearing. "Where did you lose him?" She screamed in frustration, finally forming words.
"I followed him up over the trash heap, and when I got to this side, he was gone."
She took a step and then slid down and fell in a tumbling avalanche.
"Damn it!"
I stood there watching the slipping cascade of cans. "Well, I guess there's only one thing to do." She stood back up and watched as I drew my Colt and raised my voice. "Throw a few shots into this pile and see what happens. If he's in there, I'll probably get him." There was a wheelbarrow load that hadn't made it to the mountain proper, smaller and more scattered than would have hidden a man. I raised my .45, snapped off the safety, and pulled the trigger. A few cans flew into the air. So did Kelly Joe Burns. As I'd suspected, he'd slipped and fallen, but had been smart enough to realize that the mountain of cans could provide a fine hiding place, at least before I threatened to shoot it. If we'd thought Kelly Joe was fast before, we hadn't seen anything. The man practically levitated from the cans downgrade from where Chief Long sat and about a third of the way around the base from where I stood, before remembering to throw the bag he held over the top of the pile. We both yelled at him to stop, but we might as well have been talking to the wind in both solidity and velocity. As I circled the base, I pointed toward the spot where he'd been buried.
"Get the bag!"
She stumbled and slid as I ran after the world's fastest non-Indian. Back at USC as an offensive tackle, I had been able to outrun any other 250-pound man in Southern California for 40 yards. We were now more than a couple of decades past that. I was coming up on my 40-yard limit, and Kelly Joe Burns didn't weigh close to 250 pounds. He had run toward the road, but had circled back to the front of the bar, and I could hear the sound of the Dodge's starter grinding away. I stopped at the edge of the asphalt and attempted to catch my breath by bending over and placing a hand on one of my knees for support as I pulled the coil wire from my shirt pocket and dangled it like a dead rat for him to see. He looked at me, threw open the door, and ran across Route 39, just as an 18-wheeler bellowed down the road from Coal Strip. The white cattle truck locked its brakes and blew its horn, and I watched as Cully Joe slid underneath and came up on the other side. "You've got to be kidding." I skimmed around the rear end of the freight liner full of unhappy cows when another horn sounded and caused my heart to skip like a warped record album. I was pretty sure I'd checked for oncoming traffic, but was surprised to find both of my hands, one still holding the .45, on the hood of a Baltic blue 1959 Thunderbird convertible. The car had stopped, and my daughter and soon-to-be in-law stared at me with stunned looks on their faces. I coughed and held up one finger as I lurched off the stationary Ford into the barrow ditch after Kelly Joe. Holstering the sidearm felt like the right thing to do in front of Katie and Lena, and besides, I figured I wasn't going to really have to shoot Burns. There was a well-worn trail at the base of the ditch beside a barbed wire fence. I looked north, then started off south. My daughter kept pace with the Thunderbird in low gear, and Lena, having folded her arms on the door sill, sat up on her knees to look down at me as if she were in a parade.
"What are you doing?"
I coughed again and struggled to get enough air to reply, "Chasing a drug dealer."
"I thought you were chasing a murderer."
I glanced around and jogged on. "This is kind of a side bet." They accelerated and kept up, Katie driving, Lena talking.
"Two felonies with one stone?"
"Something like that." She turned and was talking to Katie.
"The driver says to remind you that you have a luncheon in 30 minutes.
"I'll be there." There was another brief conversation. "The driver says to tell you that we're taking it on faith that since you've holstered your weapon, your life is not imperiled." I was getting a little of my air back and responded, "He may run me to death, but he's not armed, if that's what you mean."
"You're sure you don't want our help? We do our best work from Concours Vintage Automobiles."
I waved them on. "I bet." They sped off, and I watched as the driver didn't spare the horses. "Good girl." It was pretty much a straight shot along Rosebud Creek, so other than a few high stands of grass, I could see about 100 yards heading south and left toward Lame Deer. I glanced out of the swathed fields to my right and could see all the way across that flat area as well. No one. I stopped as I remembered something Henry had once told me, something about a culvert nicknamed the Time Tunnel, which was somewhere in the area. It was reputedly filled with mattresses so that those who had imbibed and didn't want to run the risk of becoming the forgotten dead up on Route 39 could sleep it off. Dire stuff, but better than being roadkill. I turned and looked north. I had automatically followed the flow of the traffic on my side of the road and started south, but what if the Time Tunnel was north? It was a crapshoot. Standing there for a moment more, I made a decision, turned, and began trotting back up the path. After about 300 yards, I came to a culvert and stopped. The grass was high, and only a little water spilled from the corrugated pipe, which was almost as tall as a man. I thought about the last time I'd climbed in one of these things, and had almost been killed by a big crow by the name of Virgil White Buffalo. I reached around on my back and felt for my venerable maglite, but then remembered I wasn't wearing my duty belt. Standing there, I could see that there was an uneven light at the end of the tunnel where it opened out on the other side. The smell of the place was less than inviting, but in I went, crouching down and once again pulling the Colt from the small of my back. "Kelly Joe, if you're there, I want you to know I'm coming in." Nothing. I kept a wide stance and trudged over the first mattress that smelled more disgusting when I stepped on it. I cleared my throat and tried to breathe shallowly in hopes that the odor wouldn't overtake me before I got out. Stepping to one side, I watched as some sort of snake slithered from under the mattress and continued on in the direction from where I'd come. I started talking to the animals again. "You're not the variety I'm looking for." I turned and reached the halfway point where one of the mattresses was bunched against another. Thinking that it was pretty much the only place where someone could hide in the confined space, and with a few more flashbacks to the other culvert down on Lone Bear Road, I put a foot on the mattress and pushed. Burns once again flung himself from cover and ricocheted down the culvert like a pinball. I thundered after him, but tripped on the corner of a soggy sleeping bag and fell forward. I scrambled to get to my feet, but it was slippery, and I knew in my heart of hearts that I was going to lose him. God hates a quitter, so I staggered forward and watched as he got to the opening at the other end, and the bright sunlight lit him up like a candle. That was when the candle snuffer came down with a vengeance. Lolo Long must have been waiting above the tunnel on the other side, and I watched with a great deal of satisfaction as she landed on Kelly Joe with all 6 feet of everything she had. She planted him face first in the mud with a knee at his back as she grabbed two fistfuls of his wife-beater T-shirt. He struggled to get at her, but it was like a replay of the events at Clarence's house when she'd pig-wrestled him. I staggered out into the light as she slapped her cuffs on Burns and dragged him to his feet, his entire body smeared with blackish mud.
"I want a lawyer!"
She smacked the side of his head. "You're going to see a lot of lawyers, trust me." I took a couple of deep breaths and could smell the strong scent of stale beer coming off of her. "Did you find the bag?" She smiled as she took the drug dealer's arm.
"I did. And inside was about 500 grams of methamphetamine in tiny individual serving baggies."
I took his other arm and we walked him up out of the ditch toward the Jimtown Bar parking lot.
"That's almost a pound of Schedule II substance, and you know what that means, don't you, Kelly Joe?"
She was happier than I'd ever seen her, as she informed him of his Miranda rights. When she finished, Kelly Joe continued to say nothing, so she turned to me.
"I'm sorry it took so long, and that I smell like an old brewery, but the cans covered up the bag when it hit on the other side of Mount Rainier, and it took a while for me to find it."
"No big deal.
Do you know how long I've been looking to get this rat?"
She laughed, and I was glad I hadn't spoiled her moment in the sun.
2 months, and this is by far the biggest bust of my career."
I was happy for her. There's a camaraderie and euphoria that goes along with these situations, when you get the bad guy with so much evidence that there's no way an informed jury or sober judge will ever let them walk. It's a feeling that is amplified only by the fact that no one was hurt and that everybody, with the exception of the perp, got away clean. Well, mostly clean. My mind kept drifting back to the case at hand, though. I thought about the dead father, the injured child, and the woman we'd watched fall. I kept my mouth shut as she stuffed the drug dealer in the back of the Yukon and turned to look at me with her hands on her hips. The smile, 1,000,000 watts, only slightly dimmed.
"Audrey."
I focused on the tribal police chief's face.
"What?"
"On the recording, the woman's voice."
I waited.
"It's Audrey."
Chapter 14. We had deposited Natty Tominski in the BIA jail, where there was a female docent. She would probably walk, as we hadn't actually seen her in possession, but a little time behind bars wouldn't do her any harm. We sat on the folding chairs in the tribal police headquarters and stared at Kelly Joe. He sat on the bunk in the corner of the holding cell, with his knees drawn up in protection. So far, Artie Smallsong hadn't made any aggressive moves toward him, but the drug dealer was playing it safe. I didn't blame him. It was like being trapped in a have-a-heart with a pissed-off badger. Artie's fingers were wrapped around the bars like the kind of vines that choked trees to death.
"I don't have any idea."
"You must have had some kind of interaction with her."
"No, I didn't."
He flung himself from the bars and started pacing back and forth, Kelly Joe's eyes tracking him like radar.
"The only time I ever laid eyes on the woman was there at Human Services when I was trying to get my mother's support check."
"No other time?" He turned the corner at the far end of the cell and started back past me.
"Never."
"Not even on the phone?" He stopped on the next pass.
"Ever."
He grabbed the bars again and Kelly Joe jumped.
"And I wasn't at that bar that night. You ask and see if anybody remembers me being there."
"Your truck was there."
"My nephew was driving it."
"With your elk on the hood?" I got up and leaned an elbow between the bars and paid a glance to Burns. I would have been lying if I'd said I wasn't enjoying the drug dealer's discomfort. "Then where were you?"
"Hunting."
The spit flew from his lips, and his face moved near mine.
"You had part of that elk. You saw it. Did it seem fresh to you?"
I nodded. "It did.
I went after another one. Now let me out."
"It's not that easy, Artie. The feds are convinced that you did it because of the recording, and we haven't come up with anything that counters that very impressive piece of evidence."
"That conversation never happened."
He pushed off the bars.
"I never spoke to her husband. What's his name?" "His name was Clarence."
Burns's voice rose from the back, and one look at him told you that he wished he'd kept his mouth shut. But he was Kelly Joe, after all, and silence was not one of his strong suits.
"Clarence?"
I nodded.
"I had an argument with a guy named Clarence in the parking lot of the White Buffalo one time."
"About?"
He left a stupid Jeep in front of the gas pump while he was serenading some teenager. I told him to move it or I was going to get all crazy horse on his ass. I looked past Artie and raised my voice so that Kelly Joe would know I was speaking to him. "You ever have any dealings with Clarence Lasbull?" He pulled at the collar of his T-shirt, feeling the heat from me and his tattoo, and then tried to cover it by resting his chin on his knees.
"I'm not talking to you."
"Okay." I pushed off the bars, leaving a few fingers on the steel like I was loath to leave. "I can see how it is that you wouldn't want to bother to help Artie with his problems. Chief Long and I are going to walk out of here in about 2 minutes anyway, so you two are going to have plenty of time to talk about things and work it all out." Artie Smallsong turned to look at Kelly Joe Burns. The drug dealer slowly raised himself up and stood on the bunk with his back against the concrete blocks.
Hey, wait a minute. I want my own cell."
I kept my eyes on Burns, but tossed my voice over to the chief. "Anything available?"
She shrugged. "Not just now. Housekeeping might have something later."
I turned back to him. "Looks like you've got a roommate for a while." His hands came out, attempting to hold the air between himself and Artie.
"Look, it was purely business. Clarence dealt in bud, that was all. Sometimes he ran short and I'd front him product, that's all."
"That doesn't make any sense, Kelly. Why would the feds be interested? It's not exactly high on their substance abuse table." The drug dealer continued to keep his eyes on Smallsong.
"How the hell should I know? Go ask them. What the fuck, you think they're pals of mine?"
Lolo's voice sounded from the hallway where she now stood.
"That's okay, white boy, they're going to be."
I joined her, and we started out.
"Hey, wait a minute."
I turned and looked back at him. Artie had moved closer to Kelly Joe, and was now standing in front of the corner bunk where you could hear his fists clenching, the sound like bark tightening.
"What?"
"I could make you a list of users."
Chief Long crossed her arms. "Oh, you and the Federales are going to get along."
Smallsong leaned in closer to him.
"You scumbag."
"Artie?"
He turned his head and looked at me. I suppressed the smile that was growing on my lips and gestured for Smallsong to move.
"Give him a little room, Artie."
I waited until he stepped away.
"How is that going to help us, Kelly Joe?"
He seemed relieved to have even the smallest amount of breathing room.
"It'd be all the people that Clarence had anything to do with."
I turned to Lolo. "You think we can trust Mr. Burns and your officers if we give him a pencil and paper to make a list?"
She looked at him. "If we handcuff him to the radiator."
I turned back to the drug dealer.
"You right or left-handed?"
I joined my family at the Law Enforcement Center parking lot as they sunbathed in Henry's convertible. The Cheyenne Nation leaned against the front fender and pointed at a mark on the hood of the 59 Thunderbird about a quarter of an inch in length.
"You scratched my car."
"I'll buy you some rubbing compound or one of those bulldog hood ornaments with the eyes that bug out and light up." He closed his eyes, canting his head toward the sun's rays like some Algonquin sunflower, as he always did.
"I understand you arrested Kelly Joe Burns."
"The chief did."
The bears silently applauded.
"Bravo."
I looked at Katie, who was applying suntan lotion to her feet.
"How was your discussion with Arbutus Littlebird?"
"I made a deal with her. They won't reschedule, but I convinced them that we could combine the wedding with the language immersion retreat."
Lena adjusted her sunglasses.
"I am beginning to think that your daughter could litigate ice from an Eskimo."
I walked the rest of the way around, Lola, and looked at the two exquisite women, replete with bikini tops and suntan oil, towels lying over the reclined seats of the T-Bird. "The Cheyenne language immersion retreat and your wedding. How are you going to manage that?"
"It's going to be traditional, performed entirely in Cheyenne."
Katie tipped her Prada sunglasses up and looked at me with her frank, gray eyes.
"We convinced her that it was a wonderful opportunity for the students to experience the Cheyenne language in a unique context."
I glanced at Lena, who had yet to move.
"How does the Moretti contingency feel about that?"
The mother-in-law-to-be rolled her head toward me.
"Ha-i-ye-na-tse-hes-nest."
I shook my head and watched the traffic on 212.
The two of you wouldn't want to work on this homicide case, would you?
Katie removed her glasses completely, but shaded her eyes with a hand.
I thought you arrested somebody.
We did, but it's the wrong guy.
A smile pulled at the corner of her mouth.
What about the drug dealer?
He's in the office making a list of known associates of the deceased, but I don't think he did it either.
Sounds like you've got more real work to do.
Yep, but we don't need you.
I was a little hurt.
At all?
She caught my tone of voice and sat up, turning in the seat and pulling herself onto the sill, clutching onto my shirt in a playful manner.
I always need you, but I don't need you this afternoon if you've got things to do.
She looked at the shirt in her fingers, especially the name Pretty Weasel.
Did you hire on?
I just needed a clean shirt.
It's not that clean.
She studied me, with the smile she reserved for me playing on her lips.
Repeat after me. Na hestona anotse.
What does it mean?
She was more emphatic this time. Repeat. Na hestona hanotze.
Na hestona hanotze. She nodded at my pronunciation.
Good. Now try this one. Ehestana.
Ehestana.
Now put them together.
I thought. Na hestona hanotze. Ehestana. Now what did I just say?
This is my daughter. He may take her.
Maybe it was the sun, maybe it was the lack of sleep, but I felt my knees give just a little bit. I swallowed and could feel my eyes well and just hoped that she wouldn't notice, but of course she did.
Her eyes softened, and she placed her head against my chest.
I'm getting married, Daddy.
I laughed, but it was short and choked in my throat.
Yep. I guess it just hit me. She pulled her head back, and I swept a wave of the strawberry blonde hair away, just a little damp from the sunbathing.
You won't have to worry about me so much.
Right.
She continued to smile. I'm settling down and having a baby. Things get easy from here on out, right?
I shook my head. Oh, yeah.
We're stealing the bear and going to Billings for supplies, but we'll be back tonight with another Moretti.
The groom?
She smiled.
He.
I asked him if he could come early and help, and besides, I kind of miss him. The rest of the family is staying in Denver till the last hour, so we don't have to worry as much about the rooms, which, by the way, we're okay. Michael, Lena, Henry, you, we're all having dinner.
I glanced at the Cheyenne Nation as if I didn't know.
At Shea Bear?
Katie retrieved her sunglasses.
Actually, at the Charging Horse Casino, if we don't get going. Could you make us a reservation just in case, Dad?
She glanced at the clock in the T-Bird's dash.
You have 6 hours to catch a killer.
Lena Moretti was looking at me again.
No pressure.
Katie kissed my grizzled face and lowered herself back down, put on her shirt, and stretched the seatbelt across her lap.
Part of me wanted to go, but I knew I'd be more help to Chief Long. I don't have a vehicle.
The Cheyenne Nation pushed off the fender of the Thunderbird and turned to stand over the passenger side door, his gaze tracking first to Lena Moretti and then to his truck parked behind the car.
I'll leave you, Res Dog.
He fished the keys from his pocket and tossed them to me, assorted fetishes, feathers, and all. I couldn't believe he actually bothered to take the keys out of the thing. I studied the fob in my hand and then looked at the rusting hulk. The bunch of them wheeled out of the parking lot, made a right, and headed for the big city.
Like I said, I don't have a vehicle.
When I walked back into the tribal police office, Lolo Long was on her way out.
What are you doing here?
I shrugged.
Abandoned.
Good, you can come to KRZZ with me. Nate called and said that he's got more for us.
What about Charles, Artie, Kelly Joe, and the impending euthanasia?
Mom brought over lunch, and she'll stay till we get back.
She pulled a slip of paper from her shirt pocket and handed it to me.
What's this?
The list of people and the medications that were on the old bracelet you found. The database only goes back about 12 months, but she said she would check and see who might have had anything critical before that that would have led to that amount of medication. She gestured toward the waiting GMC. To the radio station?
I raised a fist. Stay calm, have courage, and wait for signs. With the chief driving, we were there in 3 minutes. The same vehicles were parked there, with the addition of Herbert's Cherokee. I guess the morning drive guy finally showed up for the afternoon shift. Lolo led the way in, and the Sudoku gamer pointed toward the production studios beyond.
Bill Miller's ghost dance hovered in the speakers, and I could see Herbert, his good horse, wearing his signature mottled gray top hat with a leather-studded band stuck with a large eagle feather. He was in the on-air studio and turned and waved at us, pointing past the offices to an area where we hadn't been before. We turned the corner. Nate was sitting in a stripped-down studio about the size of a walk-in closet, his head resting in his hands as he listened intently, a pair of high-tech headphones over his ears. Chief Long stepped up behind him and casually placed her hands on his shoulders, causing the young man to leap up and turn around. Lolo raised her arms, and we watched as he slipped the headphones off.
"Jeez, you guys scared the crap out of me."
"Sorry," she smiled.
"What's up?"
He stepped past us and started around the corner.
"Hold on, let me get Herbert."
We stood there looking at the rock and roll posters of artists I certainly didn't know,